Soldiers in Love and in Crisis. Today, Wednesday, February 12th. This is The World. Sergeant Brian McGough and Specialist Kayla Williams met in Iraq. Sparks flew, and then a battlefield injury in Iraq left McGough with PTSD.
If somebody cuts me off in traffic, it's not that they just cut me off in traffic. It's akin to kind of running me off the road into a ditch. That's how my brain functions.
But for Kayla Williams, the vows said, for better, for worse.
It didn't seem that it would be fair to abandon someone who had been wounded fighting the enemy just because he was struggling and having a hard time.
Surviving war as a couple. And speaking of love, every culture talks about it, but not always in the same way.
In ancient China, the word for love connoted a very socially disrespectful relationship.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The nightmare for residents still trapped in the Syrian city of Homs. It continued today. Aid groups scrambled to deliver urgently needed food and humanitarian aid while a tenuous ceasefire still held. That ceasefire allowed more than 1,000 people to evacuate the devastated old city section of Homs. But tensions have risen rapidly between government and opposition supporters, with both sides accusing the other of using the truce for their own strategic benefit. Earlier, I got an update on the relief effort from Wall Street Journal reporter Sam Dagger, who is in Homs.
Today, they've managed in the morning to take in the bulk of the food, mainly flour and food rations and medical kits. These are things that they were not able to take in on Saturday when the UN and the Syrian Red Crescent convoy was attacked with mortars and snipers on Saturday. So today, they try to accomplish that bit. Excuse me, the bus is passing through. One second. This is a bus that just pulled in into this receiving center here next to the front line, evacuating more people from the besieged old quarter. Men, women, and children on the bus right now.
How often have those buses pulled in from the old city today?
So far, we had about 250 people, so now possibly another 50 people. So a total of 300 today, plus almost 1,200 that have been evacuated since Friday. So that brings it to a total of 1,500, more or less. You know, and today there was a real fear, I mean, that they might be attacked again. So what they did is they took these flour bags, I witnessed it, you know, out of the Syrian Red Crescent trucks, and put them onto these tows that were pulled by the armored SUVs that belonged to the United Nations. I could see the SUV was, like, weighed down, you know, by these flour bags. And then they affixed the UN logos on the tows, basically to tell whoever was targeting them, you know, these are like UN convoys, you know, please do not shoot. You could see the tension. And then, you know, this convoy went in, and it actually came out about an hour ago, and it looked like it had delivered its load.
Now, the food and medicine that went into Homs, who's going to receive that, and why would they be staying?
Well, these are about 1,000 civilians that may be related to the rebels or people who just don't want to leave their neighborhoods and want to stay. So they've chosen to stay. And the UN has really pressured the authorities here to allow these people who want to stay to remain there and for the UN to be able to help them and to take in food for them and food and medicine. There's a lot of bad blood. I mean, the people who are fighting alongside of the regime, these are young men here from the Alawite community who have joined paramilitary groups like the National Defense Force. These people have seen, like, their comrades, their loved ones killed by, you know, rebels in the war, so that they don't want to see food and medicine going to these people. So there's a lot of tension and apprehension.
Yesterday, we followed this news of hundreds of men and boys detained right after they were evacuated. The buses that have come in today, have more men been taken in as detainees?
Yes, I saw with my own eyes one bus that had about 50 people. So that's going to be another complication for the UN, you know, that more of these guys are coming in.
And all these evacuees who got out of Homs, Old City, where did they go?
Many of them went to a neighborhood west of the city where a lot of the people who have been displaced by the government offensives in Homs have gone. It's not any better, though. I mean, it's an area also surrounded by government checkpoints, or trenches all around, barbed wires, and you have like a state of almost partial siege.
The evacuees today that you've seen on those buses, like the one that just pulled in, how do they look?
Oh, I mean, they look tired, exhausted, disheveled, frail, fearful. I mean, there's a lot of apprehension because you have to remember, I mean, yes, the government said, you know, promised that they would all be given an opportunity to go through this amnesty and they would be freed. But obviously, there's no trust here. You're talking about a war that's been going on for close to 3 years now. So people are really afraid.
Sam Dagher with The Wall Street Journal speaking with us from Homs. Thank you very much for your time.
Sure, my pleasure.
Listening to Sam, it's hard to even consider a war zone and romance. But people do find love in strange places, even war zones. Kayla Williams met Brian McGough in Iraq in 2003. They were both Army sergeants deployed to a rugged Iraqi mountainside. And there, a spark of love was born. What neither of them could foresee was that McGough would suffer a traumatic brain injury and PTSD, and all that would severely test their relationship before it even fully blossomed. In her new book, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Williams describes how she felt when they first met.
I was really interested in Brian. He was smart and funny, sarcastic, witty, handsome, charismatic. But I knew that it was not the place for us to begin any kind of relationship. But I did confess to him one night that I wanted to get to know him better. And he said, oh, there's plenty of time for that when we get home. And a few months later, he was very seriously wounded by an improvised explosive device, or IED. And it looked for quite a while as if I might never get that chance.
Brian, you were in Mosul riding on a bus when that IED, when the bus hit that IED. How much have you been able to piece together of that moment and the days that followed?
It's kind of weird. I never lost consciousness until they did surgery on me. So I remember, you know, pieces, little bits here and there. And like I said, I've heard stories. So it's kind of like watching a movie.
Yeah. I mean, you have traumatic brain injury, and this was caused by a piece of shrapnel. It sounds like the size of a Bowie knife going from the back of your skull into your brain and basically out the other side. It did not look good for you, did it?
The prognosis is, I guess, when they were doing surgery on me, was that they didn't think it was going to be good. And, you know, they thought I would probably possibly live, but never be able to be kind of fully functioning and doing things on my own.
Brian was an inpatient for a couple of months, and then they actually released him and sent him back to Fort Campbell, where he didn't do very well at first. And so we got him transferred back to Walter Reed as an outpatient, where he got care for another year before he was medically retired.
They saw me and were like, well, he's walking and he's talking. In fact, I heard that many times going into Walter Reed to, you know, try to take advantage of some programs or some different kinds of medical assistance. People would say, like, oh, you look fine. You really don't need this. This is for the people that are really, really hurt. So, you know, we don't have that many assets. You should save it for them.
And Kayla, I mean, you married Brian later, knowing he'd had this traumatic head injury as well as PTSD. I know love is hard to explain, but why did you take this challenge on? We have to call it a challenge.
Yeah, the first month that we were together, I was on block leave, and he wasn't required to go into work. So we had this honeymoon period at the very beginning where we spent all of our time together. He had this initial kind of high where he was so thrilled to be alive. And I didn't notice at the beginning some of the cognitive deficits and didn't know enough about PTSD to untangle what was going on, and did fall in love. Once the extent of the problems that he was facing started to become clear, I was already deeply emotionally entangled. And it also got wrapped up in my head with this military ethos of not leaving a fallen comrade behind. Mm. It didn't seem that it would be fair to abandon someone who had been wounded fighting the enemy just because he was struggling and having a hard time.
You have to kind of get into my brain and the brain of somebody that has PTSD, that a lot of the reactions that I have, everything that happens to me is amplified. So if somebody cuts me off in traffic, it's not that they just cut me off in traffic. It's akin to kind of running me off the road into a ditch. That's how my brain functions.
At one point, Brian, you had an entire team of caseworkers, yet both of you, Kayla and Brian, you felt like you were battling these huge problems alone. Kayla, why do you think that was?
Brian was injured early in the war. He was injured in October of 2003, and the systems and services just weren't in place to care for wounded warriors, especially those with the level of problem that he was struggling with. And although he had 8 case managers, they didn't work together as a team. So if we went in to meet with his psychiatry case manager, who would say, oh, you should try this medication. Like, actually, he tried that already and it didn't work out. And the guy wouldn't have even read his files and gotten back far enough to see where that particular medication had already been tried.
I'm a little reluctant to bring this up, but you write about it in the book, Kayla. At one point, things got so bleak, you actually asked Brian to shoot you in the head. I'm just, Brian, what did you think when she makes this bizarre request?
I really don't remember the night, so I really can't comment on what I was thinking at the time. I can tell you that we both were in, you know, a very difficult place at that time. I think that was in the kind of the worst of it. So that was pretty, you know, there's a lot of despair. There was a lot of anger. There was a lot of, you know, mistrust, baseless, but there was definitely some mistrust out there and there were a lot of issues going on. So it was definitely a time where everything was culminating into one big, nasty, you know, event.
It was rock bottom for us. And I think in some ways you have to hit a rock bottom before you can start to climb out of the other side of the pit. And that was that moment for us. The next day, I broke my ankle rock climbing and ended up in a cast. And Brian had to take care of me. And I think that was the beginning of his recovery, when he got to be the caregiver. He got to be my savior. And I couldn't do a lot of things that I had been doing. And it changed the emotional tenor of our relationship and also started him on a path where, instead of having the bizarre luxury in a way of being able to let me be responsible for everything and being able to just kind of abscond all responsibilities, he had to step up again. And it helped him begin that journey, that long and challenging journey towards healing and recovery.
Today, you're still together, going strong 10 years after Brian's injury. I'm just curious what difference you think battling PTSD as a team, as a couple, has made, especially when you look at individuals dealing with it on their own.
I think it's important to kind of keep in mind that, yes, we did go through it together, but this was also kind of our journey, and other people out there that may be in the same type of situation and didn't react the same way. You know, there's no judgment there. We're not trying to say that our way was perfect and everyone should be like us.
Right.
I'm sure there are other caregivers who did a better job than I did. I wasn't always as empathetic as I should have been. But also, when I tracked down Brian's neurosurgeon to interview him for the book, he told us that 5 years after sustaining a traumatic brain injury, only 20% of patients are still married.
Wow.
80% of the marriages of TBI patients fail. That drove home to me that it sounds really weird, but it was very validating for me that I'm not crazy.
Absolutely.
It really was hard. It was hard.
No, you're beating the odds, and that's a great thing. Hard work, it seems. Kayla Williams is the author of the new book, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. Her husband, retired U.S. Army Staff Sergeant Brian McGuff, was awarded the Purple Heart for his service in Iraq. They now have 2 children. Enjoy your family, you guys. You deserve that at the very least. Thank you very much for the interview.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
By the way, we asked our online community of veterans to share their stories of how war injuries tested their relationships, and your responses helped inform my questions in the conversation we just heard with Kayla Williams and Brian McGuff. So thank you all who helped. If you're a veteran and you want to help us with our ongoing coverage, just text the word RETURN to 69866. That's RETURN to 69866. And again, thanks. This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at medtronicphilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Catch-22, The Call of the Wild, In Cold Blood, what do these books have in common? Well, at one time or another, they've all been yanked from library shelves. Now add one more to the list. On Monday, Penguin Books India pulled one of its books from bookstores in India. The title, The Hindus, An Alternative History. The recall ends a long-running lawsuit against the history book. Wendy Doniger is a professor at the University of Chicago, and she wrote the book.
It tells an aspect of the history of Hinduism that is unpleasant for a certain type of Hindu, what I would call a fundamentalist Hindu, to accept. The Hinduism that is popular with the right wing, the BJP, is a sanitized Hinduism.
And the BJP is a political party in India for our
listeners.
The
BJP is a right-wing political party in India that is looking like it may win the big elections that are coming up in May. And people on the left are very nervous about what is happening. It's that nervousness that accounts for the enormous reaction to the news that Penguin has pulled this book. Other books have been banned in India for years, similar sorts of books that made the same sorts of people angry for the same reasons. They depict a Hinduism which is vibrant, which is erotic, which has a lot of material contributed by Dalits, some people used to call untouchables, by women. These other books of this ilk have also been dropped by publishers. I knew a week or two ago that we lost the lawsuit, and I thought, well, we had 4 good years, and I'll write other books, and we'll move on from here. And I was astonished that when the news broke out, so many people felt that this was a terrible thing, not because the book itself is so wonderful, but because somehow or other they realized what was happening in Indian politics and the degree of censorship and repression that had finally come to the point where they did ban, burn, whatever you want to call it, this book, which has been a bestseller for 4 years.
So a group of academics in India filed a civil case against your book, claiming that it's full of heresies and factual inaccuracies. If it's going to a civil court, but if it's going to a civil court, what law is this violating in India?
First of all, it's really important to say that academics have not filed a suit. These are Hindus. They're mostly members of the Cow Protection Society. They are simply Hindus who don't like the book. They are not academics.
So this group, well, you say they're not academics, they're called the Shiksha Bhashao Andolan Samiti.
That's right. Your
book is not the first work that they've targeted. So who are they if they're not academics?
The Cow Protection Society is an old society from the 19th century, which argues that cows are sacred to India, and therefore people who eat cows should leave India. Those people are Muslims. They're the kind of Hindus that feel that India should be for the Hindus and not for the Muslims.
And when you were writing this book half a decade ago or so, did you have any inkling it would garner such a response?
I knew it would make these people mad, and I had actually in 2006 given a lecture in London where somebody threw an egg at me.
Wow.
A very popular historian of India, Will Dalrymple, wrote an article saying that the kind of history I was talking about was not known, it was not accepted, and Will said, someone should write a book that ordinary people can read that will tell the other aspect of Hinduism, and I thought, that's me. That's what I'm going to do. So it came out of that situation of conflict, really.
So what's going to happen now? And you just have to accept that that book won't be sold ever in India?
Right now, there are massive PDFs circulating illegally all over India. Of the book. One of my publishers said, if the intention of these gentlemen was to make sure that no one read your book, it has backfired very badly indeed.
Wendy Doniger, author of The Hindus, An Alternative History, which was recalled from bookstores in India. Wendy, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for talking to me.
Changing topics now. Archaeologists have been able to figure out when camels were domesticated in ancient Israel. The science is pretty cool. The problem is that it throws several stories in the Torah and Bible into doubt. Or does it? We asked the world's history guy, Chris Wolf, to investigate.
Camels play a significant supporting role in the Bible and its imagery. Think of the three wise men.
How are you?
We are three wise men.
What?
We are three wise men.
Well, what are you doing creeping around a cowshed at 2 o'clock in the morning? That doesn't sound very wise to me.
Unlike Monty Python's Life of Brian, it's entirely plausible that the wise men came from the east by camel, as suggested by traditional imagery. But the Bible also places camels in many older stories where it seems they don't belong. Domesticated camels are mentioned dozens of times in the age of the patriarchs, like Abraham, Moses, and Isaac, and in the time of the kings, like David and Solomon. Camels have been seen as anachronistic for some time, but now it's been proven beyond reasonable doubt that they were not domesticated in Israel prior to the 10th century BC. In fact, the scientists are sure it happened pretty close to 930 BC, and in one specific location, the copper mines of the Arava Valley.
And we see two different phases. The earlier phase, with only donkeys and mules in the archaeological accumulation, and the later phase of the late 10th and 9th centuries with ample camel bones.
That's Erez bin Yosef, one of the Tel Aviv University archaeologists who published the evidence late last year. Apparently you can tell whether a camel was used as a beast of burden by the damage to its legs. The leg bones of a camel hunted for meat look quite different. Bin Yosef says camels may have been domesticated earlier elsewhere in the world, but their arrival in Israel transformed the local economy.
It opened opportunities of trade with the Arabian Peninsula and beyond. The famous incense trade with perfumes from Yemen.
Well, what is myrrh anyway?
It is a valuable balm.
Bible literalists are dismissing the science, but it's not entirely good news for those who believe the Bible is completely mythological either. Some argue that those who first wrote down the oral traditions of the Jewish people simply allowed the context of their own times to filter in. But another argument is that we have, until recently, been completely wrong about the chronology of the Bible. Israel Finkelstein is another archaeologist and Bible scholar from Tel Aviv University.
Well, I don't know when is the time of the patriarchs. That's the problem. I think that we are now liberated from the a little bit naive thinking that the patriarchs can be dated in the second millennium BC only because they appear in the Bible in the beginning and there is a sequential history of ancient Israel in the Bible.
Finkelstein is one of several scholars who in the last few years have argued that the stories of the patriarchs probably overlap in some way with the time of the kings, like David. And he says the evidence, archaeological and otherwise, clearly places those episodes from the 10th century BC onwards. That's hundreds of years after conventional thinking.
I would use this information the other way around, which means the fact that we have references in Genesis, in the time, quote-unquote, of the patriarchs to domesticated camels is a very good indication that we are relatively late in history, which means that we are not in the second millennium BC.
Finkelstein knows his findings are unwelcome to some, but he says,
I am not in the business of making people happy or unhappy. I am in the business of conducting research.
For The World, I'm Chris Wolfe.
And speaking of camels, did you know they wrestle? Yes, they do. Sumo wrestlers use skill and technique to push an opponent out of the circle. Imagine camels with giant backpacks doing the same thing. We have a video. If you don't believe it, you can watch it at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, the Pentecostal Church from Nigeria, that's growing rapidly here in the U.S. It combines the Holy Spirit with an ambitious business plan.
Because heaven is real, God is real. And that is why we want to plant churches like Starbucks.
Plus, turns out the Babe Ruth of women's ice hockey is Canadian.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Picture for a moment Godzilla battling King Kong. Anybody else doesn't stand a chance. That's actually a good metaphor for women's ice hockey at the Olympics. The big beasts are Canada and the U.S., and there's bad blood between them. Today in Sochi, the Canadian women beat the U.S. 3-2. It was just a preliminary match. Both teams remain alive in the battle for gold and silver. Bruce Dobigan is a longtime Canadian hockey analyst and author. He tells me that this epic North American women's hockey rivalry goes way back.
The thing was, in the early days, the only teams to play really were the other ones. That was the only opposition there was. The Canadians only really had the Americans as serious competition. In fact, they grew up playing against each other. A lot of them, Canadians would go to schools in the United States on scholarships. They know each other quite well. You know, there's rivalries that go back a long time. On one level, of course, the Americans and the Canadians, it's a fantastic rivalry. They've been very successful. The problem has been getting other countries to get up to that standard.
Yeah, do the Russian women even come close to ranking?
Not really. I mean, you know, in a lot of countries in the world, I don't think it's news to anyone, the opportunities for women to play in these kinds of sports are fairly limited. So, you know, to have the equal opportunity that women do in North America is pretty rare. The only other country anyone talks about that maybe can compete are the Finns. And, you know, when they played the Canadians the other day, I think they were outshot something like 55-14. So The games are not particularly close.
I gather the Canadian women have a star on their team, a woman named Haley Wickenheiser. Who is she, and is she kind of their secret weapon?
I would say if there's a Babe Ruth of women's hockey, it would be Haley Wickenheiser. She's in her fourth Olympics as a hockey player. She's previously won 4 gold medals, but she also won a gold medal when they had women's softball in the Olympics. So she's just a great all-around athlete. Wow. And she has been kind of the poster woman for the sport. She's been the one that they pointed to. You know, she would be the person I would say is the Babe Ruth of the sport.
Now, at the Vancouver Games, the last Olympics, the Canadian team beat the U.S. team for gold. How bad are the U.S. women still kind of smarting over that loss?
They've taken every opportunity since those Olympics to whip up on the Canadians when they can. Coming into this particular Olympics, I think the Americans have won 4 or 5 straight games. And it's always on the blackboard when they go in. It's, you know, remember what happened in Vancouver in 2010. So they are very determined. And today was a little bit, I would have to say, was a bitter defeat for the Americans. I think they really wanted to show, you know, that they had completely come back from the 2010 loss.
Yeah, well, there's still the medal match. I've heard people call these games between the U.S. and Canada at the Olympics kind of the Stanley Cup of women's hockey.
Absolutely. It's the World Championships, the Stanley Cup. It's everything rolled into one. And for these young women, as I say, they dedicate their lives to the sport. They don't have what you would have in the NBA or the NFL or the NHL with playoffs where you're on the television all the time. For the 4 years in between the Olympics, people don't pay that much attention to. This is everything rolled into one for them. So this is like a game 7 of the World Series every time they play for them because it has that kind of magnitude.
So what will it do to Team USA if they don't get what they came for?
Well, you would presume, this being sport, that you double down and you say, okay, obviously there's something we're missing. We've got to do something better. I think the bigger question will be, you know, how long the International Olympic Committee will continue to have hockey in the Olympics and allow these women to perform like this, the Canadians and the Americans, if the other competition doesn't come up to scratch, because they do evaluate sports over time to see whether they're making progress. And it's pretty clear that hockey hasn't made the progress that they've wanted for it. So we would hope that they provide a really good game and that it's the kind of thing that keeps the IOC from questioning whether ice hockey for women should still be in the Olympics.
Right, so ice hockey for women, but not ice hockey altogether.
No, ice hockey has been there since the 1920s, and there is an analogy here. In the 1920s, the Canadian team used to beat people 20-0, and the games were lopsided then, and the supporters of women hockey point to that and say, well, look, that's our sport. We just need a little bit more time.
Hockey analyst and author Bruce Dobigan, thanks very much for your time.
Anytime.
Brazil's got the next Olympics, the Summer Games in 2016, and before that, the World Cup will be in Brazil this summer. So the country's been busy trying to get ready. But something else has been making headlines there in the past month or so. Rolezinhos, or little strolls. They started as a way for low-income youth to socialize and flex their purchasing muscle, but they've turned into social protests, and it's all happening in shopping malls. Zoe Sullivan has more from the city of Recife.
Ramon Cesar was one of a handful of young people who responded to the call for a Rolezinho in Recife's most exclusive mall. Ramon's 18, slender and soft-spoken, and he has dark skin. He says he's tired of the way he gets treated when he enters a mall. Ramon says just because he's black and wearing flip-flops, 2 security guards follow him. Rolezinhos weren't designed to be protests. They began as a way for young people from Brazil's new middle class to leave their low-income communities and hang out in a social space. Recife activist Janina Oliveira says there aren't many safe spaces for young people in many parts of Brazil.
The best place for a young person to relax is at the mall, in the food court, or maybe in the movie theater.
The first Rolezinho took place at a mall in São Paulo. Word of it spread on Facebook, and about 6,000 showed up, most of them young people of color. This was in early December. The gathering was peaceful, though it was definitely animated. There were rumors of thefts and assaults, so the malls moved to quash the phenomenon. In mid-December, 22 people were arrested at Jolezinho, and police used rubber bullets and tear gas to break up another one. The Jolezinhos, and the reaction to them, have sparked a heated conversation in Brazil about race, class, and social change. With Brazil's economy growing, there's a new population of people with money to spend, and some Brazilians aren't ready for that, says Noelia Brito, an activist attorney in Recife.
Minha visão é o seguinte.
The current government likes to say that it promoted a new middle class, but this new middle class is a middle class that is considered second rate by the traditional middle class.
The Jolezinho in Recife didn't wind up drawing that many people. Fears of violence kept some away. Those working at the mall were also a little nervous.
Espero que não vire bagunça como a gente vê no Rio de Janeiro, São Paulo, né?
Andrea Lorenzo says she hopes the Jolezinho here doesn't turn into the kind of mess they saw in Rio de Janeiro and São Paulo. But she also says she's fine with it, as long as it doesn't cut into her sales commissions. That's a big issue. Mall operators have complained that the Jolezinhos are scaring away customers. Marcela Marquez is shopping here, and she says she's all for the freedom of expression, as long as it doesn't interfere with other people. If it does, then it's up to the mall to handle it.
I think the mall should be prepared, since one of its main promises is to offer security and serenity to the public.
The Jolezinhos didn't grow out of last year's protests surrounding preparations for the upcoming World Cup and Olympics. Still, they're another sign that the country's social pressures are bubbling to the surface, at a time when Brazil wants to seem as welcoming and stable as possible. For the world, I'm Zoe Sullivan, Recife, Brazil.
Valentine's Day, it's coming up, in case you hadn't noticed. It's hard to escape the commercialism of that day. Question, though, different cultures have different rituals when it comes to love, marriage, and courting. But does love itself differ? That's a question Catherine Winter has been thinking about. She's a producer with a new PRI program called The Really Big Questions. Her search for an answer takes us to China and into the human brain.
On weekends in downtown Shanghai, hundreds of people go to the marriage market at People's Park. Parents line the sidewalks, displaying descriptions of their sons and daughters on white pieces of paper. A man who identified himself as Mr. Lan is hoping to find his son a wife, a woman with a good character.
You wouldn't marry a girl from the barbershop because she's pretty. You have to consider whether the family will accept the choice. Because falling in love isn't simply the matter of two people. It concerns the whole family.
The idea of marriage as a transaction between families has deep roots in China and in many other places. Historian Stephanie Kuntz says in cultures with a tradition of arranged marriage, falling in love is disruptive and dangerous.
Falling in love before marriage in India was considered an actively antisocial act. In ancient China, the word for love connoted a very socially disrespectful relationship.
In fact, it used to be widely believed in academic circles that people outside of the West did not fall in love. They thought romantic love had been invented by European troubadours and didn't exist outside of Western culture.
We decided to see if that was really true or not.
Anthropologist Ted Fisher co-authored an influential paper in 1992. He surveyed studies of 166 cultures looking for evidence of love, such as elopements or love poetry.
And we found it in an overwhelming majority of cultures. We thought it's very likely that romantic love is found in all cultures.
But people in different cultures describe love differently. In some Asian countries, surveys have found that people are more likely to stress the negative aspects of love than Westerners are, things like jealousy and heartbreak. If you stop people on the street in Shanghai and you ask them about love, you hear a lot about communication and working at love. You hear about duty. The word that comes up again and again is responsibility.
Responsibility.
Being involved in a romantic relationship is a lot like having a job, actually.
This is Jessie Chun. She's a 24-year-old accountant sitting at a Shanghai cafe.
2 years ago, I would say getting married is more about loving someone. But now I'm getting more and more practical.
So does the practical, responsible way Chinese people talk about love mean they don't fall in love? That's what Mona Xu wanted to know. She's a psychology professor at Idaho State.
It's really difficult to know, are people accurately reporting their experiences? And there's this drastic difference between how Westerners experience love and how Easterners experience love. Or is it that culture is influencing how people talk about it or how familiar they are with even being asked these questions?
To find out, Mona Xu decided to look at people's brains. She recruited Chinese men and women who said they were in love and put them in an MRI machine to see what happened in their brains when they thought about their sweetheart. Then she compared them to similar brain scans of people in America and England.
And we found that they were almost identical.
In both the East and the West, researchers found activation in parts of the brain associated with thinking, but also in areas associated with addiction and euphoria. This would suggest that love is love, no matter where you are, even if culture influences how we talk about it and think about it and feel about it. And of course, culture can change. These days, some Chinese people are adopting a more Western, romantic idea of love.
Love feels like you're walking on a beach, hearing the sound of waving coming over and over and over again, while your feet is touching the sand softly.
Suzette Xu is 30 and lives in Shanghai.
Once you felt the kind of feeling when you're in love with someone, it just it's really addictive to me. Even you know you may end up with getting hurt in the end if the things doesn't work out, I would take a chance on love.
Suzette Xu says she thinks some people in China are still marrying out of duty or for financial security, but she's holding out for someone who sweeps her off her feet. For The World, I'm Catherine Winter.
Catherine Winter is a producer for The Really Big Questions from Sound Vision Productions with funding from the National Science Foundation. She had reporting help from Rebecca Cantor and Shi Fan in Shanghai. You can check out photos of the Shanghai marriage market at PRI.org. Now to a city better known for love, Paris. The lights, the romance, the food. Oh, man, the food. We're going to tell you now about a place in Paris's old Jewish quarter whose menu will make your mouth water. And it's a falafel joint, hip yet old-fashioned. New York chef David Tanis explains why he loves the Ace of Falafel so darn much.
There's an old falafel shop on the Rue des Rosiers in the Marais, which is the old Jewish quarter, which, like pretty much every old Jewish quarter everywhere, is now being overtaken by boutique shops and hipsters. But there are still a few old shops in the quarter, and three or four restaurants, and all of them try to make falafel, but there's one that makes the best falafel, and that is called L'As du Falafel, which translates as the Ace of Falafels, or the high card. So this place is kind of unprepossessing from the outside, sort of painted with shiny green paint and, I don't know, a few little placards that say Lenny Kravitz ate here. I don't know that much about the owners, but I imagine they are from Israel. There's a big poster of Tel Aviv on the back wall, and it's pretty much mom and pop, although mom wears a leather jacket and bright lipstick and has a nice hairdo, and pop is kind of modern looking too. Which is not to say, like, overly welcoming. It's the falafel place that has, like, the most buzz. It's just buzzing all the time. And people are standing online and waiting to get their in the door, and the waiters are running around, and over here you have the two Tunisian guys working as fast as they can, making all these crazy falafels and stuffing them into pita. First goes in a spoonful of cabbage salad made with red and green cabbage, onions and olive oil and kind of garlicky. And then some chopped cucumber salad goes on top of that. And then goes the tahini. Then the falafel go in. And then on top of that comes a few strips of grilled eggplant. Really luscious, oily grilled eggplant. When they bring it to the table, they just hand it to you, and you're all set to begin eating because you don't really ever put it down.
Now, New York chef David Tanis is more than just a lover of Paris falafel. He's also the author of One Good Dish. We had production help there from The World's Alex Gallifant. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. For centuries, European and American missionaries have gone to Africa to spread the word of Christ. That trend is now working in reverse. The World's Jason Margolis tells us about one of Africa's most influential Christian movements, now preaching the gospel here in the U.S.
Drive an hour northeast of Dallas, and you'll find yourself staring off into a barren, flat horizon. One building rises above the landscape, a 10,000-seat auditorium. It's the centerpiece for the Redeemed Christian Church of God in North America, a Pentecostal movement that started in Nigeria in 1952. They claim more than 5 million followers worldwide, mostly in Nigeria. It's one of the fastest-growing evangelical churches there. Pastor James Fedeli runs the church in North America. He says God told the church's leader that their North American headquarters would be near Dallas.
Where in Dallas? We don't know. When will that happen? We don't know. One of our members, they went to a restaurant, all-you-can-eat restaurant to eat. Unbeknown to them, there is another Caucasian that lives in this area, have bought 103 acres of land, and God told him, the land doesn't belong to you. It belongs to a group of church people. When you meet them, I will let you know who they are.
Fedeli, a short man with a booming voice, says the church members at the restaurant were then approached by the Caucasian man.
He went to them. I don't know who you guys are. A year ago, God asked me to buy this 103 acres of land. I've bought it. But God says you are the owner. They accepted it. They paid the check. And the rest, they say, is history.
The divine spot near Dallas is unincorporated Floyd, Texas, population 220. The church's property now spans 700 acres. They have grand plans here to build a university, a sports complex, even a golf course. And that 10,000-seat arena, it has the capacity to expand to fit 100,000.
Crazy people for Jesus. People are in love with Jesus. Shouting hallelujah, praising Jesus, having prayer vigils, having fun, giving each other high five.
Beyond Texas, Fedeli's goal is to establish a church within every 10 miles in North America to take as many people as possible to heaven, he says.
Because heaven is real, God is real. And that is why we want to plant churches like Starbucks.
We praise thee, O God, for the song of thy love.
I visited a parish in Melrose, Massachusetts, near Boston. About 120 people were there. That's larger than average for a Redeemed church. Once parishes start to grow, they quickly split to create more branches. Church leaders say there are 720 churches in North America, nearly double from 4 years ago. They have perhaps 15,000 members in the U.S., a figure that's all but impossible to verify. Ruth Marshall with the University of Toronto studies Christian movements in Africa. She says the Redeemed Church's aggressive plans stem from its leader and guiding force, Enoch Adiboya in Nigeria.
He really wants to be an important global player. And one can say that he's almost obsessed with this logic of church planting, because for him it's an index of success. And also, prosaically, the more parishes there are, the wealthier the central organization becomes, because each pastor has to reverse 20% of gross revenues, tithes, offering, fundraising, to the headquarters in Nigeria.
Marshall says the U.S., where Pentecostalism began, holds special appeal to church leaders. She says they believe in a manifest Christian destiny from Africa.
And there's a great image that captures this. I've heard this many times from pastors and from Nigerian Christians. If you turn Africa on its side with the bulge facing down, you'll see that Africa is the gun and Nigeria is the trigger. We have pulled the trigger and shot the bullet of global revival.
Their struggle pits the powers of Jesus against Satan. Their passion for their mission is clear. At the church service in Massachusetts, people were dancing in the aisles, hugging, and breaking into conga lines. The PA system was cranked way up. People sang with arms outstretched and eyes tightly shut. The place was rocking. Again, these are Pentecostal Christians who believe strongly in faith healing and miracles and speak in tongues to connect with the Holy Spirit. There were young and old. Children were downstairs in their own service, and toddlers were running around the lobby. Nearly all Redeemed Church members in North America are Nigerian or African immigrants. I did meet one white woman at the church who is originally from the Boston area. You can watch a video of her and some other church members on our website, PRI.org. For the church to grow, they'll need a lot more non-Africans. Ruth Marshall says that'll be tough.
I think they're faced with this problem within their own population, in fact, because we're looking at what's going to happen with the second generation. So a lot of these Nigerians, a lot of the people who go originally to these churches are Nigerians who are relatively recent immigrants. But now they have children, and their children may be leaving the church because they want a church that's more relevant to the lives of, you know, the average American teenager or young person.
Back in Floyd, Texas, Pastor James Fedeli is not discouraged. He says it'll take some time, but they will connect with the greater community here. One way to do that in Texas, at least, is through that huge auditorium. Fedeli says it's available to rent for weddings, rodeos, whatever. He says when people learn they are genuine, they'll join his church.
It's just as if you are half a $100 bill that is fake and $100 bill that is real. How do you know which one is real? Do you know which one is fake? But by the time people start to use it, people start to look at it, they will know which one is genuine. I'm not saying all the churches in America are fake, but we, God helping us, Redeemed Christian Church of God, we have come from all the way from Africa. We're engaging the people to show them the true gospel, making sure that people are saved and people are making it to heaven.
For the world, I'm Jason Margolis, Floyd, Texas.
Nigerian evangelicals, in fact, holy men of all stripes, were a favorite lyrical target for the late Nigerian musician and songwriter Fela Kuti. I'm sure not everyone appreciated his anti-religion songs, but the sound he innovated, that jazzy, funky style known as Afrobeat, there doesn't seem to be any place immune to the groove. Let me introduce you to one group that has embraced it, the Alma Afrobeat Ensemble from Spain. The band actually formed with a handful of players in Chicago in 2003, but to get plugged into a more global frame, they packed up and moved to Barcelona. They got what they wanted. Their second CD, which came out last week, is titled Life No Get Duplicate. The Alma Afrobeat Ensemble out of Barcelona, Spain, puts the wraps on our program today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org. The Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at RitaAllen.org. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.